We are listening to...
This is Valera Unbalanced.
Episode 2, Ghosts.
Let's ask the simplest question first. What is a ghost? Is it a dead person haunting a site, or a collection of energy endlessly repeating itself? Is it an angel? Is it a demon? Is it hoax or imagination? Or is it possible that there are still things we just don't know about yet? With all of our technology that can end life or save it, how much do we really know about death and what happens after death? What is a ghost? About 3/4 of an ounce, according to Dr. Duncan McDougall of Haverhill, Massachusetts. In 1907, he tried to weigh the soul. For his experiment, he kept 6 terminally ill patients in his office, each on a bed scale accurate to 2/10 of an ounce, or 5.6 grams. McDougall did not wish to have the delicate scales damaged and the measurements thrown off by thrashing patients, which is what most people do when dying. Instead, he chose patients whose illnesses caused great exhaustion and little movement before death. It was a cold, clinical, rational decision. He needed to be as precise as possible in his measurements if the scientific community were going to pay it any mind, and a calm, relatively non-moving patient would be the easiest to measure accurately. This was later described in his paper in the April 1907 edition of the journal American Medicine, entitled The Soul, Hypothesis Containing Soul Substance Together with Experimental Evidence of the Existence of Such Substance, where he declared,
"At the end of 3 hours and 40 minutes, he expired, and suddenly, coincident with his death, the beam end dropped with an audible stroke, hitting against the lower limiting bar, and remained there with no rebound. The loss was ascertained to be 3/4 of an ounce."
When McDougall repeated the experiment using 15 dogs, he found no such difference in weight. This fit in perfectly with the conventional mindset of the time that dogs had no soul, and lent credence to his theories. Before his paper could even be published, the New York Times March 11th issue declared, "Soul has weight, physician thinks." And instantly, the common knowledge became that the soul weighed 3/4 of an ounce, or 21 grams. There are, however, a few complications with his findings. A test group of 6 patients is just not statistically a significantly large enough pool to draw data from. Also, the announced result was only from 1 of the 6 patients. Of the remaining 5 results, 2 were discarded for technical difficulties, 1 lost 3/4 of an ounce after death, only to regain it shortly thereafter, and the other 2 patients registered an immediate weight loss at the moment of death, but then lost more weight a few minutes later. By selectively reporting only 1 of the 6 results, his findings were cast further into doubt. Add to that the complication of determining the precise moment of death and the type of death. Are we talking about cellular death, brain death, physical death, heart death, legal death? Did they die a little or a lot? This case is a fine example of how, even in a field taken quite seriously at the time, experiments in the field of parapsychology often provide just enough science to vindicate the believer and vilify the scientist, making the subject of life after death so taboo among their peers that most scientists won't even study or speak of it. In this episode of The Libra Unbalanced, I interview a man who is part of a growing movement to bring science and objectivity to a question that, to this day, we still do not know the answer to. What is a ghost? Our guest is Steve Gonzalez, technical manager for the Atlantic Paranormal Society and one of the core investigators on the popular sci-fi channel show Ghost Hunters. On any given show, he'll be the one you see from beginning to end, always setting up the cameras, grips, computers, analyzing the data, and presenting the findings to Jason and Grant. He is the workhorse and technical know-how of the team, and it's a pleasure to have him on our show. Steve, thank you for joining us. There's a lot of spiritual and technical questions that surround ghosts, but first I wanted to ask you, what is a ghost?
What is a ghost? I tend to think that it's what everybody thinks it is. You know, the standard textbook, spirits or people rather that have passed and for some reason are stuck here. They're stuck here because they have unfinished business or they want to achieve something, maybe communicate with somebody. And I'm sure there's many other reasons why they're still here that we don't quite know. I mean, I don't think that's the only way that we get these ghosts or the only reason that they're still here. I'm sure there's many, many ways, but that's what I think. I think that it's the people that are here and have passed and can't quite make it to wherever they need to go, and they're still here. Or it's people that have passed and have used conscious thought to get themselves back here. You know, I need to go back to Earth and talk to Mary or whatever their thought process would be. They may get themselves here. Not quite sure exactly how they get here, but I definitely think it's the once human person that is now past, not living anymore.
If I may ask, what is it that you personally hope to achieve through these investigations?
Personally, for myself, I definitely want to answer if there's any sort of life after death. I'd like to get the answers of what these things are, why they're here, what exactly they're doing, you know, all the answers that we want, that people think are the basic answers everybody wants answered, or questions around that everybody wants answered. Is there life after death? Are these things, are these ghost spirits here, on their own will? Are they stuck here? I'm not here to prove anything to anybody. I think everybody should make their own stuff. And if you're like me, you don't believe anything until you see it or experience it. So I hope most people are like that. I'm definitely not here to change their minds.
What are your thoughts on non-ghost related paranormal phenomena? You know, like psychic powers, UFOs, Bigfoot, that sort of thing.
I personally don't believe in psychics or mediums. I don't think that everybody out there is a sham or lying to people who claim to be psychic. I just think that maybe they're misled, or they think there's a lot of things that we don't know about, such as micro movements. The FBI studies people's micro movements, and just a little twitch of the eye may mean a yes or a no. You know, just the way they look could mean the difference of the names of different states, and there's all these different things where people will actually analyze micro movements in humans. And there are a lot of researchers and doctors out there that think that the actual psychics may be people that are doing that subconsciously, just reading people that way without the training. I personally have worked with over 40 psychics and have yet one of them to prove to me that there's any legitimacy to it. I believe in UFOs. I think that there's kind of too much buzz about them to maybe not have anything here. I haven't seen one or experienced anything. But I kind of think we're foolish to believe we may be the only living organisms in this universe. Bigfoot, cryptozoology. I do think that there could be something out there, but I'm of that mindset, like many others, that why haven't we found them then? If there's a Bigfoot, why haven't we found any remains or any signs that they exist? A lot of people say maybe they buried their dead or whatever they do, but I'm not sure. I think the jury's still out on the cryptozoology, but I definitely think there's probably UFOs and aliens and all that stuff.
So it seems you take a pretty objective, technical mindset to these investigations. Have your personal religious or spiritual beliefs changed any as the result of your investigations?
I tell you, I think that my religious beliefs have become a little bit stronger. I've always believed in, Jesus and all that stuff in the Bible and Christianity, but I've never really been I don't want to say crazy, but, the people that just follow that to a T, and I think people may call them Bible thumpers or whatever, but I've never been very, very into it that much, but always had a belief. And I think the investigations and seeing what I see, whenever something, nasty is happening, and you pray and you see that whatever nasty is happening goes away, and you feel a lightness in the room, and there's just a lot of things that have led me to believe that there probably is, a religious being up there watching over us, for sure.
Have you ever encountered a higher religious being by any chance?
I don't think so. On all the cases, I've never had anything that's happened that's made me go, oh, this is a, angelic spirit. So I don't think that I've ever experienced anything quite like that.
Have you come to any additional insights regarding the journey to the other side?
I don't think so yet. I think the only thing that it's been able to indicate is either there is a life after death, if we are communicating with these people, or they're communicating with us, or there is another plane of existence that's crossing over into our world somehow. And, you know, it's got to be either one of those two.
In a past interview, you said that Ghost Hunters has about a 20% result ratio. That's very impressive. A lot of paranormal hunters go their entire lives without a single experience, but y'all manage it about 1 in 5 times. What do you attribute such a prolific amount of paranormal experiences to?
Yeah, you know what? We do see about 20% of the cases where we find something. It's not always, you know, something that we could say, oh yeah, that's definitely, you know, a spirit or a ghost. It's just something that leaves a scratch in our heads, you know. You know, 2 out of 10 cases, we'll find something that we go, you know, that's not quite right. That doesn't make sense. There may be something else going on here. And you're right, that is quite high. But what we've done lately is with the show, is we've had to take, you know, cases, because let's face it, if something happens in the show, the ratings are better. And that's what the production company, that's what sci-fi, that's what everybody wants. So what we do is we try to go on the cases that have the highest frequency and the highest amount of activity that is going on, the highest frequency, the highest, you know, degree. And I think that's what helps us, is we're taking places that people tell us, oh, stuff happens every day, 5 times a day, everybody's experiencing it. Not the places that are like, well, you know, once a month we hear this noise or see, you know, someone walk down the stairs. We're finding places with high frequency, which definitely, you know, helps out our chances of capturing something. And we are seeing about 20%. It's not always, well, always 20%, but we're seeing about 20% right now, which is good. Because before the show and before I actually even joined TAPS, I went probably 4 years straight without experiencing anything. So we've been lucky the last few years.
So it sounds like a large part of it is just narrowing it down to the best places that seem to have the highest chance of capturing something. Are there any other criteria that you use to decide which sites to investigate? And with the growing demand for TAPS investigations, how might this change further in the future?
You know, we do have a pretty big screening process where people have to go, people have to answer a lot of questions, and we have phone interviews and sometimes even face-to-face interviews. A lot of people don't know this, but there's actually a whole section of TAPS that investigates and doesn't do the show. It's just investigations. We call it the TAPS home team. And the investigators that never make it, not that they don't make it, but they never are on the television show, and they just do the cases that are in and around New England. And so that with our screen process, you know, we don't only go to California. You know, people see us going to Seattle or going to San Francisco, and they say, oh, well, what about everybody in Rhode Island, all those cases. But we have a whole team that is constantly screening the cases, going on cases throughout New England, and we just do the traveling.
Many people are impressed with the show because of the technical nature of it rather than the dramatic. Why do most of your investigations only happen at night?
Well, they don't. We do investigations all throughout the day. As a matter of fact, we just did a battlefield, and we did that from noon until 6 p.m., actually, what it comes down to is most of the time that's when the client is available. You know, they say, hey, you know, you can come by 9 o'clock, 8 o'clock. And on the other token of that, there's a lot of phenomena that we try to capture that is illuminated. You know what I mean? Like a glowing ball of light or a mist that's slightly illuminated that appears. And if all the lights are on, you won't see that. You won't see it. You know, if you're in a room and all the lights are on, you turn your flashlight on, you're not going to see that beam of light. You turn the lights off, and you're going to see that beam of light. And we need to make sure that we're going to capture everything or see everything if something's there. And also, when you turn the lights out, we'll find you keep all the lights on, people still whisper, clients whispering, people talking, not really paying attention 100%. You turn all the lights off, all of a sudden, everybody is silent. Everybody's paying attention. Everybody's looking at their surroundings. The clients are no longer chattering amongst themselves. They're quiet in the corner. And, you know, it really just helps the investigation, I think. And the key is, you know, there's a lot of stuff that happens that is illuminated that you wouldn't see if the lights were on.
I was wondering what your opinion is of the K2 meter used in the Manson haunting.
The K2 meter, you know, Chris Fleming brought that
And Chris Fleming is a really cool guy, really nice dude, and he's really into what he's doing. And he brought that to us, just saying, "Hey, here's a device that I'm working with, or whatever his pitch was." And he said, "I'd like to see what you guys think of it." And I know Jason and Grant are pretty partial to it. Grant likes to use it sometimes, and I think it's an all right secondary tool. I wouldn't use it as one of my first degree tools. And the reason is it's very, very easily manipulated. For one, the button on it, if you just put a little more pressure on it with your thumb, you can get, the lights can kind of flash and give you a little false reading, so you got to be very sensitive with it. Not to mention, it's not grounded properly, and so it could also be picking up electrical pulses in your, in your arm and your hand. It could pick up static from your clothing and from your body, where as an actual EMF detector that we usually use is better shielded for that sort of thing. But I think maybe as it advances, it can be a little bit better. But on the other token, they use it as a yes and no device. You hear yes for, blink once for yes, blink twice. But you could do that with anything. You could do it with an EMF detector, Hey, here's my EMF detector. Pass by it twice or make the needle jump twice. It's the same thing. You don't need a K2 meter to do that. You could do it with anything. Even a compass. Hey, spin my compass,
You mentioned first-degree equipment. What would be your ideal first-degree equipment for an investigation?
I think number one, of course, is yourself. The best equipment you have is your eyes and your ears and your own perception. And, the tools that people have been ghost hunting for hundreds of years, they didn't have EMF detectors back in the day when Houdini was ghost hunting, but he had probably better results than we ever have, And I think that if you're really going to use the electronics, I think yourself is the number one, and then probably a camera or a video camera. Actually, a flashlight would be number one, because you don't want to be stuck in the darkness. But the flashlight would definitely be number one. Then probably some sort of recording device. You need something to record what's happening. If something happens, you want to be able to get it on film or get it on video, capture it on audio. And then I think maybe some sort of detection equipment, like EMF gauge, a thermometer, an ambient temperature thermometer, probably things like that. And if you don't want to do the EMF, you could use a compass. Of course, the best tool of all that we've ever had is the thermal camera, which reads the hot and cold signatures just like the Predator sees. And that's been our most valuable piece that we've ever used, but it's incredibly expensive. So I don't think if it wasn't for TAPS and the funding that we've been able to put together, we would have that that kind of equipment. So I'll leave that out of my list. But definitely a flashlight and probably a camera, a video camera, would be the only two real necessities, I think.
Have you ever considered any biological paranormal detectors, such as dogs or cats or birds or something like that, to help y'all out?
We haven't, but what we have done is taken into consideration that the animals on the premise, there's always pets and animals, not always, but on a lot of cases, and we have utilized them. We've put a case study together, and we found that people that have done that test, there has been no difference in results. There's been no difference whatsoever. And vets and doctors will tell you that the animals don't have another sense. They don't have a separate eye in their forehead or anything that's letting them see these things. What they may be picking up on is just a different sense in the energy. Something's bothering them. There may be something that is just not right to them. And it could be anything from high electromagnetic fields to electrical sockets leaking electricity to, some televisions, if they're not on the right frequency, make a high-pitched squeal. That could be bothering them. There's lots of things that bothers the animals on the cases. Not to mention, if you bring them on cases, you definitely got to keep very, very close eye on them, because they're going to give you a lot of false activity. A lot of people will see the dog run by and not realize it's a dog. It's dark out. They'll think they're seeing a shadow. You may hear the dog walking. A lot of times we've had animals on cases, and all of a sudden you're listening to the audio and you hear all this crazy noise and you think it's something, and then you realize it's just the homeowner's pet or whatever.
One of the most popular requests I've seen on the forum was asking whether or not y'all would consider wearing helmet cams to avoid the did-you-see-that near misses. What would your thoughts be on that?
Helmet cam, I think it would, you could, but it would be awfully cumbersome to try to investigate. It worked on that show Fear, which was on MTV, and Taps was actually involved with that. Jason Grant set up some of the cases for that show. And, you know, it worked well on that because they're in all these big, huge, huge places, and it's very easy to get around when you're in an asylum, you know, with a helmet cam. And they only went in for maybe 15, 20 minutes at a time, but we go in for 12 hours. And I don't know, I'm not about to wear a helmet cam for 12 hours. I'd rather, yeah, not into it. But
not to mention that would probably multiply the number of footage that you'd have to see by a considerable amount.
Oh, yeah, and not to mention, it would have to be some sort of IR. And, you know, if the IR is going, if the IR camera is facing out like that and you're just relying on that footage, you're going to see all kinds of IR shadows. You're going to see all kinds of stuff. I really think it would make it more of a mess than what you'd be into. I mean, the key is to have a camera in every single room, every single hallway, blanket it completely. So if anything happens anywhere, you'll capture it. Helmet cam may be a nice idea, but unless it's for you know, some hardcore experimentation, I'm not wearing one for a whole investigation.
Another thing people had wondered about is, since ghosts apparently drain energy to manifest, have y'all considered rigging up a device that leaks energy as a sort of amplifier or a lure for the ghosts?
Yeah, we've done many tests with that. They're pretty extensive, actually. We've had a doctor, a guy named Ron Milioni, who has many PhDs. He's built us many generators that we've actually set in haunted spots and let them leak tons of electricity or whatever the charge is into the atmosphere. And because you're right, they say that you know, more energy or electricity could act as a catalyst for paranormal activity, you know, enhancing it. But we found no results whatsoever. And every team that we've talked about that has tried similar things have not found any better results. If anything, it adds an element of danger because all these things have exposed wiring and exposed tubing, where if you come close to it, you'll definitely electrocute yourself. I have a gear guide on sci-fi.com, which is a bunch of videos of just all the equipment that we use, and it's on sci-fi.com. You just go to it. It's called Steve's Gear Guide, and one thing I highlight in there is the ion generator, which is one of the tools we use to leak the electricity into the atmosphere to positively charge all the ions, and you'll see it on there if you want to check it out.
Now, you probably get asked about every single site on the planet as to whether or not y'all are going to agree to investigate it, but there's one that was asked more than any other, and I have to ask. Have you ever heard of the Lincoln Ghost Train? And if so, does Ghost Hunters have any plans to investigate it?
I haven't heard of the Lincoln Ghost Train. I'm not familiar with it, no. I mean, we will check out anything. Anything that is supposedly haunted, we'll check it out. And that's not for the show. You know, we have other, as I said, the home team that'll do anything. And if not actual TAPS, we have the family groups all over the world. We have we definitely have one in each state, if not many more. And if people send in enough requests to our case manager, just casemanager@theAtlanticParanormalSociety.com, you know, places that we get a lot of requests, we definitely check out.
And for the sake of our listeners, the Atlantic Paranormal Society has a dash between each word on the URL for that. Is there any place that you feel is more haunted than the rest?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think any place that there's been a tremendous amount of trauma, mass suicides, mass murders, mass you know, any sort of mass death or mass trauma definitely has a higher possibility. Meaning, if we go to a hospital that only four people have naturally passed away in, as opposed to a hospital where 300 people passed away in, and they did things like torture and, you know, shock treatment, things like that, you know, 9 out of 10 times you're going to find a lot of activity at that crazy hospital than you will at the hospital where not much has happened. So I think anywhere that there's a high degree of, you know, unfortunately, a high degree of death and despair, you have a pretty good chance of finding something. So I think any of the big hospitals like Waverly Hills, which will actually be at, you know, Halloween night for our live show, Waverly Hills, there's an armory in New Bedford that we did that had some deaths. It was pretty crazy. It doesn't mean that there's always going to be hauntings and there's a lot of deaths, but it definitely lends to the possibility.
Has your work ever followed you home?
Thankfully, no, it hasn't. I've never had anything follow me home. There's been times that I've thought, perhaps. I remember a couple times laying in my bed and hearing, like, a, you know, noises I've never heard before, like walking up and down stairs after a case or wind blowing weirdly, you know, but nothing that's definitely made me go, wow, I can't believe I brought a ghost home. But, yeah, no, not for me, anyway. And I've never done anything like cleansing or sage rubbing, whatever they do, but I've never done that, so I've been lucky, I guess. Been lucky.
Have you ever run across anything paranormal that you'd consider dangerous?
No. I think to be dangerous, there has to be a possibility of severe injury or death. And, you know, in all the cases of paranormal activity, there's only been one document where somebody died. And it hasn't been because of the paranormal. It's just been that they were so scared and they were an older person, their heart couldn't take it, and it gave out. You know, it's not necessarily because this thing was saying, I'm going to get you and going to kill you. It's just that, you know, he was that afraid, and his heart gave out, which is very unfortunate, but that's not from the paranormal activity itself. It's just he was an old man and couldn't take it. You know, there's been times, I mean, if you can get past the fact that, yeah, you may get pinched, you may get pushed, maybe even smacked or scratched, these are things that, you know, for a few minutes are kind of painful or maybe or startling, but I wouldn't say that it's dangerous. You know, I mean, I wouldn't want little kids running around having trying to have fun with it, but if you're an adult and you're, you know, you're into to being scared for a few minutes, I think it's a lot of fun and not really too dangerous. There's a lot of people that will disagree with me and say, you know, there's demons and there's this and there's that and there's things that come at you and they're going to throw furniture at you and they're going to possess you and curse you and put a stigma on you, whatever they're going to do, but I've been doing this for 15 years now and I've never once come across anything that, or even come across another investigator. I've worked with hundreds that have come across anything remotely what they feel is putting their life in danger.
Jason once mentioned an investigation where the Catholic Church confiscated filmed evidence of furniture rearranging itself and took over the investigation. Can you comment on that at all?
You know, I've heard that case, but you know, it was before my time in TAPS, and I don't know too much about it, so I'd rather not talk about it. Only because I don't really know. I mean, I'm an open book. I talk about everything. I'll tell you about anything I know. And, you know, so will Jason Grant, but I don't know that enough to comment on it, to be honest with you.
Fair enough. Have you ever been to AboveTopSecret.com, and if so, what were your thoughts on it?
I haven't been, no, I've never been, but I'll check it out now, for sure, now that I've talked to you and heard, you know, now that you have a forum and things to look at, I'll definitely check it out.
Yeah, you all have a lot of fans there. We'd love to have you and love to have you pay us a visit.
Sure, absolutely.
Well, Steve, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. Is there any final words that you'd care to share with your audience?
You know what? I'd just like to mention that we do have a magazine. It's called the TAPS Pair Magazine. And it's a magazine that, of course, chronicles what we do in our cases and, of course, the television show Ghost Hunters. And a lot of inside information about that. But it's also every single facet of the paranormal you could ever dream of is chronicled in that magazine in a factual manner. Everything from cryptozoology to outer space to, you know, of course, hauntings and you know, science, black hole, anything you could think of that could be, you know, slightly out of the ordinary is in that magazine. And I think people love it. So thanks for letting me plug it. TAPSparamag.com.
TAPSparamag.com. Well, thank you very much. We all look forward to watching you on Wednesday, October 31st at 9 p.m. Eastern.
That's right. Yep. That's where I'm headed. To Louisville.
Oh, really? So that's where you're headed right now, then?
That's where I'm headed right now. Everybody gets there tomorrow, but I'll be there today because I don't fly. I drive.
Yep. Well, it sounds like there's going to be a considerable amount of setup time involved then.
Oh, well, you know, it's a big production when you do a live show, and it's not necessarily that we have to get there. It's just that's when everybody's arriving. It's when all the crew will be getting there, And, you know, our actual investigation won't be until Halloween night, and it will be live. I think there's only really a 3 or 4 second delay, if that, just, you know, for the transmission of the waves. And it's going to be a good time.
Excellent. Well, we sure look forward to it. Thank you again, Steve.
No sweat. Thanks, man. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you. Just Warming Up by Two Libras. Hear more of their music on garageband.com/Two Libras. Our guest today was Ghost Hunters technical manager Steve Gonzalez. You can find more about Ghost Hunters at sci-fi.com/ghosthunters and theatlanticparanormalsociety.com with or without the dashes. And the first song you heard was Mona from the album Organic Dance Didgeridoo, composed by one of my favorite artists, Jeremy Cloak, of the group Resonance. You can find more about him at resonance.co.nz. Special thanks to DJ Dave Rabbit of ATX Mix for his technical help with the interview, and to the good members of AboveTopSecret.com for listening. The Libra Unbalanced is brought to you by
Infinite Monkeys. Yeah.